Greetings. This is Alex Arif. I'm the producer of the Late Set podcast, dropping into your feed today to let you know that in conjunction with the Late Set Radio Hour, we are resurfacing our interview with vocalist Michael Mayo. Why resurface this episode? Well, because on February 1st, the Grammy Awards are happening, and Michael is nominated for two awards, Best Jazz Performance for his take on the Miles Davis song 4, and Best Vocal Jazz Album. The Late Set hosts Nate Chinnin and Greg Bryant interviewed Michael Mayo on the wake of the release of that album. The album is called Fly, and we love this album here at WRTI. It's getting a ton of play, and it's featured on the most recent episode of the Late Set Radio Hour. The Late Set Radio Hour, if you're not already familiar, is kind of a repackaging of the Late Set podcast for broadcast. We air full songs with excerpts from the podcast. So we've just aired our episode with Michael Mayo, and the last Sunday of every month, we will be airing these Late Set Radio Hours. It's a really fun chance for us to dive back into the archive and re-present interviews from the past. Next month, I believe we're doing an episode with Brandy Younger on February 22nd. Now, back to Michael Mayo. So Michael Mayo came into the studio to visit WRTI. He had just come off of a plane from Amsterdam, and he fought the jet lag, stayed awake, and as you'll hear, you can't even tell, he's got great ideas to share and great stories to share, too, about the making of Fly, coming up in LA, some of his mentors working with Wayne Shorter. This is a really well-rounded interview from a fairly young artist that I hope you all can check out and get to know. And now quickly, a little housekeeping. We did release a new episode of The Late Set earlier this week with trumpeter Dave Douglas talking about his new album, Four Freedoms. And looking ahead, there's another Douglas, Desron Douglas, in the queue. That's dropping on February 3rd. A terrific interview with Desron Douglas and Josh Jackson, recorded live at Solar Myth for Ars Nova Workshop. That's all I have to say. I'm going to hand it off to Greg Bryant and Nate Chinnin, speaking here with Michael Mayo on The Late Set.
A tethered mind is a sign of life's worth living now. You feel connected through the ground, but as you grow, you eat, you sleep, you know. The ground way down below is where you will return. This bag of bones.
We are elated to have with us on The Late Set the wonderful Michael Mayo. How's it going, man?
Good. I am very, very happy to be here with you guys today.
It's a real treat. It's a real treat. Loyalty is the top word here. Michael has endured red-eye flights to get here with us in person live in Philadelphia. He's got great new work that we're going to talk about. But, man, thanks for just putting in the extra mileage to see us today.
Hey, my pleasure. That. Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here. And, in fact, after a red-eye, doing stuff is better than not doing stuff. Otherwise, I would be out. I would just be falling down on the ground somewhere.
These are road-tested insights.
Yeah, exactly.
From someone who knows. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, so you were just in Amsterdam, and I imagine you performed some of this material.
Yep.
What was the reception like to these new arrangements and the new stuff you got?
Yeah, it's crazy because the album has been out for such a short amount of time, you don't expect to go halfway across the world and to have people already sort of know the music. And this album feels super different from the last one because the last one, obviously musically it's different, but the last one came out during the pandemic. And so I didn't really get to start touring it until it had already been out for a year. And so by then, the people who had gravitated towards it already had had time to sort of really sit with it. So I expected now that no one would really know the stuff, but I showed up there and people were already singing along, and that is just such a crazy experience.
I want to ask you about one tune. We'll talk about several,
sure.
But I didn't know what time it was.
Yeah.
I didn't know what time it was. Then I met you.
Oh, what a lovely time it was, so sublime it was too. I didn't know what day it was. You held my hand, warm like the month of May it was. And I'll say it was grand, grand to be alive, to be young, to be mad, to be yours alone.
Tell me a little bit about that arrangement and what attracted you to that particular tune.
I fell in love with that song originally after hearing Cecile McLaurin-Salvant's version of that song, which is really amazing, very different than the one that I did. But that was my sort of in to the tune. It had been, I think a lot of us who listen to, learn, study jazz have, it's very common to have a list of tunes that you'll probably learn someday. That song was on my list for a long time, but I never really took it upon myself to learn it until I heard her do it. And I'm like, ooh. Oh, okay, there's something there. And so in the process of putting this album together, I was just compiling a list of about 50, 60 tunes, and I had to boil it down to about 10 or 11. Mm-hmm. And I knew that I wanted to have something that was just completely a cappella on the project, because that's a very large part of what I do, is vocal arranging. And so my plan, which ended up not happening, was to track everything in New York with the live band, and then come back and use those remaining 2 weeks to track vocals. All the supplementary vocals, all the songs that I hadn't written the lyrics to yet, to just like finish that stuff. And then also spend that last week recording the a cappella thing, which I at that point had decided was going to be, I didn't know what time it was. But surprise, I caught COVID.
Ooh.
And I completely lost my voice. And so all this time that I had suddenly got completely demolished. And so by the time I started having voice left, I only had a week to literally write 3 songs worth of lyrics, record all of my background vocals, and also arrange this I didn't know what time it was thing. But one thing about me is I work very well under pressure. And so it just like the arrangement kind of just like spat itself out of me over the course of 2.5-3 days. And then I immediately had to leave to go do some teaching in Florida. So it kind of was a whirlwind. But I'm really happy with how it turned out. I don't know. I felt pretty locked in when I was working on it.
It shows. It feels really good.
Thank you.
And to that end, I really appreciate the way that you kind of came out on Mac Avenue. Your first album, primarily original material. Mm-hmm. Now we've got basically half and half.
Yep.
Tell me kind of the methodology in choosing to step out first as a writer, composer, arranger, mm-hmm. and then splitting a difference on the new record.
Thank you for that question. It's a good one. I think for me, when I was working on Bones, I knew that I wanted to make a really strong first statement, because I had some people who already knew who I was from home and from around town in New York, and I knew that they knew my whole deal. But, you know, it's different when you're sort of doing your first presentation of self in a big way to the musical community. And so I really wanted to come out strong as a singer, composer, arranger. And I think I did that. I'm really, to this day, so thrilled with how Bones turned out. And I'm really grateful to that record, because I feel like because of what I was able to sort of establish musically on that project, it's given me the freedom to go in whatever direction I want. And so when it came to recording Fly, I knew that I wanted to record at some point, even before I made Bones, I was like, I knew at some point I want to record a more semi straight ahead jazz record, because it's such a huge part of my musical upbringing. And I really want to pay homage to that and all the amazing teachers I've had, all the amazing music I've listened to. And I decided when I was working on album number 2 that maybe it's time for this one. And the whole idea behind this project has really just been about learning how to let go and learning how to trust your instincts, learning how to trust your first mind, and learning how to just sort of let yourself fly. That's why I chose to call it Fly, because I tried to be very active in not limiting myself and not imposing too many restrictions in the creative process, just kind of like let it flow and let it out. And I think that's what happened. I'm really proud of it, and I hope people will gravitate towards it.
You know, there's another meaning of the word fly, which is an adjective. And I think about the contemporary spirit on this record.
Mm.
Jazz singers and jazz instrumentalists inhabit the same space. They breathe the same air, but they don't always operate on the same frequency.
Sure.
And when I think about your collaborators on this record, Nate Smith on drums and Shai Maestro on piano and Linda Mahon Oh on bass, what you're doing as an arranger and as a front person is entirely congruent with the energy on their projects. You know what I mean?
Sure.
There's no distinction. And I wonder if you can speak to that because you're upholding this tradition that has, it's so rich and it has so many great practitioners, some of your heroes.
Yeah.
It seems to me that you're really, really intent on making sure that your practice is humming on the same frequency as like the musicians.
Yeah, I mean, thank you. That's extremely flattering. I think something that I was very intent on in the process of putting together this album, just even as a as an arranger, but also as a producer, was I really wanted to find ways to highlight the band. Because, you know, yes, the album has my name on it. And yes, like I wrote a lot of the songs. But at the same time, I like to get to take myself out of the equation and just look at the band and be like, how can I actually make these people shine? And they already shine because of who they are, but I wanted to sort of pave the way for that as much as possible and kind of allow them to just illustrate who they are musically. And so I did a lot of listening to their own projects when I was figuring out some of the arrangements and when I was figuring out how I could conceive of hearing them all together. Because, you know, I'd played with all of them many times, but never at the same time. And so you can feel a resonance with someone when you play with them. And I knew that they would all get along. And I knew that they had also played with each other in many different things. But for me, the main thing was just how can I, let me listen to a lot of their music, listen to a lot of their playing, listen to a lot of their side person stuff that they've done and their own original stuff, their own arrangements, and just see if I can let that kind of, I'm going to invent a word here, osmosisify. Oh, okay. You know what I mean? Just sort of get into my whole brain situation in conceiving of this record. And it wouldn't have felt complete had I not done that. Because for me, it's when I'm bringing a group of musicians together, it's not just about having like random piano player template to just play the sheet. I want them to bring who they are to it. So it was really important to me to actually get to know their musicality on a deeper level in that way.
Yeah, I think you really hear the result. Yeah.
Another hallmark of the way you do what you do is your command of intervals. I'm really amazed by that because, you know, unless you're Layla Hathaway or somebody, you know, you're singing one note at a time, but the way you're able to, as you're improvising, outline a chord or give a good firm sense of harmony one note at a time. Who were some inspirations for you vocally or instrumentally in developing that?
Yeah. I mean, how long do you have?
As long as you want, man. Yeah.
Okay. So specifically when it comes to the interval thing, I mean, for me, the biggest inspiration for that is Bobby McFerrin. Like there's no like specifically if we're talking about that, like there's no contest. I heard his record, The Voice, when I was in college, and it completely rearranged my whole thing. I had heard him before and I thought it was cool, but the first time I heard him, I was probably like 14, 15. And to me, it occupied the place of general music, general family, black cookout music. But I hadn't yet developed a lot of those deeper musical intuitions yet. And so when I was in undergrad And I finally actually listened to that whole album, The Voice, from start to finish. I was just like, well, damn.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't even know this was possible. So he's one. The first person who really made me sort of catch the improvisation bug was Ella.
Hmm.
So the summer before I started high school, I went to the LA County High School for the Arts. And a lot of crazy, amazing people. Gretchen Parlato went there. Gerald Clayton went there. A lot of really awesome folks went there. And before I started that school, in that summer, my dad gave me Kinda Blue. And my granny, my mom's mom, gave me Best of Ella Fitzgerald, like her 300 Best Songs compilation. So suddenly I was literally 13. And I went from not knowing anything about jazz to at least having heard a lot of amazing jazz, a lot of amazing music. And I didn't know how to do it, but I knew that I wanted to do it. So Bobby, Ella, Sarah Vaughan is really high up on the list for me. Betty Carter. I would say Gerald's on that list as well, just as an improviser. I think his music, in terms of like people more in the modern era, when I heard his album Two Shade for the first time, that really opened my ears up. Tigran Hamasyan is on that list. Walter Smith is on that list. I mean, I could keep going, but there's so many people that have influenced me in a lot of different ways. And whether or not you can directly hear them, they each make up a little bit of the tapestry.
Yeah, that's important, musical socialization, and that you had parents that were hip enough, not just as singers, but as music fans, to get that into your ears. But how is it challenge-wise getting them on your record and getting them, your parents, to do what you need them to do as you've featured them on a cut on Fly?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, I mean, I started the tradition on Bones, and I think at this point it's just going to be a tradition forever now. It's like, if I'm making an album, I'd like to have my parents on it. I realize more and more over time just how weird and not normal and extremely fortunate of a situation I have to have them as parents. They're both so incredible and have been operating at such a high level for so long. And, you know, you grow up and it's normal, right? Like the first career I knew that one could have was that of a professional musician. There was for me, and I know that this is not shared with a lot of my musician peers, for me, it was like, oh yeah, it's right there. It's as easy as breathing in that way. In terms of getting them on Fly, I knew that I wanted to have them on the project, but I didn't know at the beginning what it was going to be. I didn't know what song it was going to be on. I didn't know if I was going to write a new song for the three of us like I did on Bones, or if I wanted to have them sort of lay on top of a song that was already on the docket. And the concept for Fly was always super clear to me. I wanted it to feel like the song that never ends. I wanted it to feel like family. I wanted it to feel like bounce. And I wanted it to feel just like happy, effervescent, bubbly goodness. You know what I mean? And I was like, I feel like if I'm trying to go for a family, maybe I should have my literal family on the song. And so I asked them if they'd be down. And of course, they were like, yes. And I sent them the demo because I demoed out all the songs for the record. And I'm like, so, Dad, what I definitely know is I'd like for you to play the vocal melody with me on saxophone. And Mom, if you could do a background vocal arrangement. I don't want to be too specific because I kind of want to just let you do your thing. So I sent that to them and then went to New York to record with Linda, Shai, and Nate, finished that, and then sent them the live version so that they had that to work off of. And then I came back to LA, caught COVID, and then it got better. And then we got in the studio and recorded it. And it just was so easy. We worked so well together. Like, our blend is crazy. We kind of sound like one person at this point. It's kind of wild. Yeah, it just was a really unironically wholesome moment.
You mentioned that it's not all that common for someone to have parents who are in and of the music. When I think about singers today, one example that comes to mind is Samara Joy, who we've featured at WRTI. Of course, she has Philadelphia ties through her family. And that brings up a point that Greg and I talk about from time to time. We've kicked around this idea, and I'll pose it as a question.
Okay.
Are we in a golden age of jazz vocals? Because when I look at the field, right, yeah. you already mentioned Cecile, mm-hmm. who I admire mm-hmm. as much as anybody making music anywhere.
Yeah.
Cecile, Samara, we have elders working now like Dee Dee Bridgewater yep. and Diane Reeves and Kurt Elling and yep. Cassandra Wilson. And then I feel like almost every week I'm hearing about someone new who's, you know, like 20 or 21 or 22 and
yeah.
you cock your ear and you're like, oh, there's something there.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I want to just lob it to you. Mm-hmm. Like, how do you feel about the state of the art? Does
yeah.
it feel like an exciting time to you?
It definitely does feel like an exciting time. I mean, I think the whole social media thing is such a mixed bag, obviously, but I think one of the inevitably good things about that is that people just have a lot more exposure to really high caliber music, and it's just so much more easily accessible now than it ever has been. And so I think the people who would have already had that sort of musical orientation, or who would really resonate with this sort of music, but who never would have gotten the chance otherwise, exposure. And I think it actually is kind of wild to see how many new people are coming up doing stuff. And for me, it was kind of the pandemic cast this in a new light for me. I was talking to a friend the other day about how it's funny, like, as a millennial, how going into the pandemic, millennials were still the main character, right?
right.
And coming out of the pandemic is just fully Gen Z now,
right.
which is fine, and I don't feel insecure about it at all. But yeah, exactly. But it is kind of funny to see, because now you have all these amazing new young people who are just operating at a super high level, who know things that I certainly didn't know at their age. And one cool thing that I think I'm starting to see, especially now that, you know, I do a lot of teaching and I go to a lot of different universities and stuff and do master classes and stuff, the questions that students are asking are just really thoughtful. And I think the sorts of questions that people ask say a lot about the state of the scene. And so I'm always really heartened to see that sort of thing. And I do think that there's just so many amazing singers that are out right now and that will continue to come out, aka, like, I should probably keep shedding so that, you know.
I think you're secure, man.
I want to know what one of those good questions might be. What have you heard that you were like, oh?
I did a workshop recently at the Conservatorium in Amsterdam. Someone asked me, so the classic questions you get are, what are you thinking about when you're improvising, or what's something that you wish you would have known when you were in school our age? Someone asked me, what sort of things do you like when a piano player is comping for you in a trio sort of environment versus in a duo sort of environment? Or I should say with like a full band, or when you're just playing one-on-one. And these are questions that I've thought of unconsciously. And I've thought of comping generally and had conversations about comping in general. But to have the student, you know, they couldn't have been more than like 19, 20, specifically be very pointed and ask, okay, so what do you actually prefer them to do? Is there any difference between when you hear a piano player comping for you in a quartet versus duo? Are there things that are in common, things that you prefer in one and not the other? And I'm like, wow, it really made me think. And yeah, I really like, and I remember I had teachers who would say things like this, and it isn't until you sort of get on the other side that you understand it. But students can also be great teachers to their teachers. And that's something that I find really rewarding. And yeah, now I'm going to have to start thinking about what I want my piano players to do when they're comping in duo versus quartet.
It's interesting to think about, though, the bright side of these young Gen Zers who mm-hmm. are coming out killing.
Yeah.
But in a practical sense, how the gig economy is, mm-hmm. it's still tricky to navigate.
Yeah.
I've seen you at Rockwood Kill on the Bones tour.
Mm-hmm.
I've also seen you stand flat-footed on a stage with a looper or a piano by yourself and go out and kill. How do you decide what to present, and how do you encourage folks to be ready, will be my word today, mm. for a situation that might be tricky to navigate performing their art as itinerant people?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard. I think I can really only speak from my experience and from the experience of my peers through conversations. I think a lot of it is trial and error, and there's such a balance, especially when you're first starting out, there's this balance between, they say you're supposed to take every gig and say yes to everything, but then sometimes if you say yes to to the wrong thing and allow yourself to be treated in the wrong sort of way and you set a precedent, then we know where that path leads, right? And it's also, you know, we can't sit here and lie and say that everything is going great and the economy is doing great and the government cares about freelancers, obviously. Like, I'm not going to lie about that. So usually what I tell people is there are a few things that will best pave the way for whatever your version of the career are. And I think tied for first place is probably self-care, rest, practice of the craft, and community. For me, those and the only reason I wouldn't put self-care, rest first is because, and this is just for me, is if I put that in first place, then sometimes I'll just literally stay home and never go anywhere ever. And so sometimes a rule that I like to set for myself is like when I'm debating if I want to go out or to do something or to be social, push myself if I can, but say no if you have to, right? So I would say to people, just like, just keep practicing. There's no way around the craft. Like, if you're really serious about wanting to have a robust career in music where you're making creative music and operating at a high level with other people who are operating at a high level, there's no way around practice. Mm-hmm. But you also have to be a part of a community and be visible and be easy to work with and just have general good vibes. And I think the sort of like networking dance is exactly that. It's a dance. I've made networking faux pas, as have everyone else, right? But in general, what I'd say is just focus on the music. Let the music guide your path and keep practicing and keep listening and keep experiencing music as a player and as an audience member. I think if you do those things, you're going to set yourself up really well.
Do you think of yourself first as a vocalist or as a jazz artist? Is that a distinction that you ever draw for yourself, or is it only when people ask you pesky questions?
Honestly, I don't know if I draw a line, because for me, when I feel most connected, it's when category falls away and I just feel like a blob of musical expression. You know mm-hmm. what I mean?
Yeah.
And I can just kind of just be and express outwardly, inwardly, whatever. You know, gun to my head, I'd probably say singer first, just because that has always been my way in. And also because, you know, growing up in my family, singing is how we literally communicate. That's if my mom is calling me from my room, she's doing it operatically. You know?
Yeah.
So vocalizing for me is a sort of a first language. So I would probably say singer first, but in terms of when I'm actually making music, I'm just trying to sit in the music and use whatever vehicle feels appropriate for that.
That makes a lot of sense to me, because here's the thing: that seeing you live, it strikes some of the same chords for me that I get from observing Bobby McFerrin, which is that the voice is so bodily, like present. It's so embodied, right? Which is kind of a stupid thing to say, because that's true of every voice. But the way that you work with the instrument, it's like from the soles of your feet up. And so Bobby is like so in tune. And you mentioned that album, like it's a brilliant example of how fundamental, how elemental the human voice is, but also how malleable and even liquid it can be, you know?
Yeah.
And I get that from you entirely, you know, just this sense of like, it's so it makes sense to me that the voice would be so essential. I wonder if you can talk too about the accessibility of that, because when I think about audiences responding to improvised music, especially when it's so riddled with harmonic and rhythmic complexities, many of the musicians that you work with, what they're doing is like quantum physics.
Sure.
And you do the same. I wonder whether it's been your experience that people sitting in an audience, there's almost like a way into it more because you are using an instrument that they themselves also have.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I think that's a really astute point. I think, I do sort of think that people naturally gravitate towards a human voice. And I don't even think that they have to like the sound of the human voice to grab, because we're just so used to responding to a voice, right? Because we're doing it right now, right? I can't speak for audiences, but I think for me, something that I typically try to go for is I usually am not purposely trying to write hard music or whatever. It just ends up happening that way. But I've always really gravitated towards this idea of if there's a storm going on, I want there to be some element of calm that carries people through that they can sort of ride that wave with. And in fact, for me, that kind of is the energy of specifically of the song Fly, is because it's really calm. There's a lot going on in there, but, you know, we have this doom, 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 doom that's going out throughout the whole thing. So I think people are going to walk away from that song with something to sort of hum or whistle. I've always felt that a lot of music that maybe on its face is hard, quote unquote, I can only enjoy it because there's something latch-onable. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I like making music that is both surprising yet familiar, like something that you feel like you can take a bite out of, but that still will maybe throw you for a bit of a loop here and there. So yeah, it's interesting. And it's crazy to watch people react to it too, because, you know, going to jazz school, all of your friends are jazz musicians and all the people you work with are jazz musicians and everyone you know is a jazz musician. So like watching just people who are not musicians vibe with the music is such a cool feeling.
It's and
like
flip out over it.
Yeah, like maybe we're doing something right.
Yeah.
I think that's a really good hallmark too of your generation. You know, how we were coming up. I'm not that much older than you, but coming up, checking out Seamus Blake and Kurt Rosenwinkel, stuff that was, again, complex. Every so often they would give you something to latch onto. And I love that music.
Yeah.
But I really resonate with marrying this visceral thing with the cerebral thing. And I even think back to a legend, somebody like Wayne Shorter, who I make no mistake about. I miss Wayne.
I only
was around him once, but I really miss him.
Same.
Was socialized on him early. And to hear you bring forward Speak No Evil was a really comforting thing here on Fly. I appreciate that. Did you ever get to hang with him? Did you ever get to be in his company?
Yeah. So when I was at the then Thelonious Monk, now Herbie Hancock Institute, Wayne was often one of the artists in residence who would come and work with us. So I was fortunate to get to spend a good amount of time with him. Never enough. But yeah, I was always just so stricken by his ability to just look at the world and be amazed and then go on to create amazing things that would amaze the masses. But also amazed by his ability to create something that, to unabashedly create something that not everyone will resonate with, and to do it and to know that he's doing it and to do it anyway. And I think there's such a beautiful power in that is really hard that, or I should say that can be hard for some people because, you know, at the end of the day, just a lot of people just want to be liked, right? He has this way of, feeling like he's completely untethered from the ground, but then when you take a step back, you actually realize he's like more deeply connected to the ground than any of us ever will be. And like, I don't know, I feel like I learned so much from him by just, I learned so much from him before I even met him, just, you know, same as you guys, just listening to his music, but then getting the chance to interact with him and just like listen to him speak and watch him exist was such a lesson in that sort of humility and awe mindset, childlike wonder thing. It's such an important thing that I have to remind myself to never let go of. You know, we're just trying to play at the end of the day.
Yeah. So, Michael, our producer, Alex, actually hipped me and Nate to something today that we were unaware of.
Yeah.
Shrek is Love.
No, this was new to me.
Wow. Like, as of today.
Yeah.
Amazing.
I missed out, but not for long. I'm on the train now.
Yeah, I mean, welcome. The water is great.
Thanks, man.
The swamp is great.
Dig, absolutely, indeed. Tell us a little bit about that, though, man.
Yeah, so I have a band called Shrek is Love, and the whole band is devoted to the movie Shrek.
Right on.
And it started off as a joke, and it continues to be a joke. It kind of starts. So it's me, Jacob Mann on keys, Nick Campbell Destroys on bass, Christian Newman on drums, it started when Christian and I were both at the Institute in grad school, and we got together with Nick and Jacob, and immediately the connection was, we had barely just met and it felt so good. And we just decided on a whim as a joke, what if we made our band, named our band Shrek is Love, and we booked a show at the Blue Whale without having any music written.
Oh man.
And we ended up writing a set of music that went on to become our first EP. And it just snowballed into this thing that has this really beautiful and niche following. Everywhere I go now, someone's like, Shrek is Love. It's so crazy. It's so crazy. And to everyone in that band, it's so cool to just watch everybody rise because we're all so busy. Christian plays with Jacob Collier. Jacob plays with Rufus Wainwright and Nowhere. And Nick plays with Scary Pockets. And, you know, I do the stuff that I do. And so we're all just all over the place. And it's been so cool to just watch people enjoy that project from afar. Like, the song that most people know is called Lord Farquaad. There's a song called Fiona. There's a song called This Is My Swamp. Giant Steps to the Castle. It's a whole thing. It's a whole thing.
Is it a gigging proposition? Do you still get together?
We've played many times. In fact, we just played two gigs in July, I think, which was the first time we'd played in probably 4 or 5 years since before the pandemic. But now that we all live in the same place again, I was the one sort of ruining the vibe because I was living in New York. But now that I'm back in LA, the plan is to play more, and we might be recording a volume 3, but it's a secret.
Okay. Okay. You heard it here first. Man, it's been our pleasure and a real treat to have you here today on The Late Set, man. We wish you the best, and keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you so much for having me. This was great. I really enjoyed all the talk, all the questions. Thank you so much.
Our pleasure.
One small step for ogres and men, a giant step to try and make you mine. Once they bring you back home to me, you'll be my queen until the end of time. Yeah, I'm coming.
Princess need a rich man, and you got mild cash.